And of course, he was killed them, and you know, this conflict over fruit trees, even as a orangutans, if they have nothing to eat in the forest, they'll, the forest is gone, they'll come into people's you know, orchards and gardens and eat their fruit. And of course, people get upset. They depend on what they grow. You know, that's where their food comes from. So they tend to be intolerant of animals eating their food crops. They will kill orangutans. They will kill other animals. They come and raid their rice fields. So, and so the future is not the best for any of the great apes, including orangutans.
Can you, can hear me? Can you speak on what extinction of orangutans look like if we're continuing to head in the direction that we're heading?
You mean the extinction?
Yeah. Like, what does that look like?
What does that look like, yeah, in terms of, like, maybe as we progress forward? Great.
Well, it's very interesting that you asked that question, because I think it's like the title of that movie, Eyes Wide Shut. But it actually appears right in front of us, and we don't see it. Most of the time, we don't see it. So most of the extinctions that have happened have not actually been documented very well. So they tend to happen out of sight and even out of mind, because it's not spectacular. You know, an animal dies in the bush, carcass is covered by leaves. You don't even know that that's the last one of his subspecies or her species to die. So what extinction looks like, it's not like a blaring neon sign. It's not like that. It happens right in front of you without you actually seeing it. So how do I view orangutan extinction? Well, in the mountains of central Borneo, which are still relatively inaccessible, there's no roads up there, there would probably be lone, nomadic old males wandering the forest, never meeting anybody, long calling. Probably wondering why nobody is calling back. So that's what's going to happen. You're going to end up with a few males in the middle of Borneo calling, wondering why they have this domain all to themselves now. And they'll die. It'll be a him. The females will be gone, because the females are not nomadic. The females tend to stay put in their relatively large home ranges. Males tend to be nomadic, so they wander. And the wild pigs will come and eat them, which they do. That's what happens to carcasses on the forest floor. I mean, it happens because animals don't advertise.
But there are solutions, as Dr. Galdikas tells us about the role of ecotourism.
So one of the things that we did very early on is we tried to build up tourism. Well, you know, the problem is, if you're in an area where there's one plane a week, and that plane, if it doesn't come this week, you have to wait another week. And if there's no infrastructure, there's no hotels, if there's nothing, it's very hard to build up tourism. But as the area became developed, I mean, I would go out. I used to give a lot of lectures, more than I do now. And I would say, you know, if you really want to help the orangutans, come to Borneo. Come and visit. You know, make it clear to the local people and to the government, local, provincial, national, that you care about tropical rainforests, you care about orangutans. And actually, I gave a talk at the American Natural History Museum in New York. And I remember, it was 1987, I think, that I gave a talk there. And one man heard me talk, and he came in 87, And then he started coming regularly in the 1990s. And he came for about 30 years, almost every year, every second year. And he died at 95. And the last time that he was there, he was 93. You know, so people like that, there was a lot of people who came, they liked it, they'd come back, they'd, you know, let their friends in North America or Europe know, mainly North America. And the tourism gradually built up. There was a hotel that built a resort-like lodge on the boundary of the national park, and they started advertising. And now, in 1971, 1972, we had zero visitors, zero, aside from Indonesians. And then 1973, we had two visitors, or one visitor. 1974, we maybe had two. And now, we have 18,000 a year. So it began in the 21st century, and it's making a difference because there are at least several hundred local men and women, actually a few women as well, who are now making their livings from being guides. And of course, what this has done, and also boats, there are at least 50 Klotoks, which are like African queens. You remember the movie, African Queen? Those kinds of boats with inboard motors, kind of. There's at least 50, 60 boats on the river now. And the people have cooks, you know, and they have the captains and the captain's assistant. So several people make their livelihoods off those boats. Of course, the boat owner might not even be on the boat. So thousands of people are making their living from the orangutans and from the forest. And what that has done is that it has built a constituency for orangutan conservation and forest conservation. Unfortunately, it hasn't yet spread to all orangutans. It's concentrated on the orangutans in the national park where the guides normally take the tourists.
I really wanted to ask where was it? Yes, okay. Can you share, I should speak a little bit closer. What message or advice do you have for our generation to be good stewards of the planet?
Well, I'd say the first thing is become a vegan. You know, the consequences of raising, you know, all that flesh and meat to eat is tremendous.
A lot of energy. Hmm? A lot of energy goes into that. Wasted energy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they've done all kinds of studies. Even eating chickens. I gave up eating chickens a while ago, you know, because the amount of forest that is destroyed for cattle ranching in places like the Amazon is tremendous. And like you said, it's wasteful. The second thing is try not to consume palm oil. I mean, if there's one thing that people can do that makes an immediate difference for orangutans is avoid palm oil. You know, when I think about unsustainable palm oil, I mean, it's like eating or drinking orangutan blood or given blood. I mean, that's how severe it is. I'm waiting for the day when they will actually have sustainable palm oil. I think the third thing is to live a life that's as clean and as noble as possible. I think that ultimately will help orangutans and gibbons and many of the wildlife that is going extinct certainly locally in Southeast Asia. Yeah, so I think those three things. But the first is try to eat as little meat as possible. And I heard a wonderful talk by actually an actor, female actor, Alicia Silverstone. And she said about vegetarianism and veganism, she said, you know, just don't give up. Just keep on trying. You're not going to be perfect, but make the effort. Because it's going to make a difference ultimately. You know, I think that's one of the best trends among young people nowadays. In the United States, I think about 20% of of high schoolers now are either vegetarian, vegan, or leaning in that direction. And that's going to have an impact on what happens to this planet. I think also people choosing not to have too many children. I think if you have 8 or 9 children nowadays, it's being irresponsible towards the Earth. So the Earth can't support more. And if you've seen those Bornean jungles disappear under the onslaught of people, wonderful people, smiling people, gracious people, you know, which are the Indonesians, you know, probably the most wonderful people on the planet, if you took kind of, you know, measures of smiling ratios and things like that. Very gracious people, very hospitable. But yet, you know, they swarm in and destroy the forest. When you go into pristine places, you often destroy them. So sometimes it's good to go to places, you know, which are already developed. So, you know, I sometimes go to places, and even in British Columbia, and, you know, I won't go on the tour, I won't do anything like that, but I'll just go to the souvenir shop. I know my job as a tourist. And I'll buy souvenirs. And then I'll give them away as gifts. I mean, I know what my job is. My job is to help the local economy wherever it is.
Right.
Yeah, it's not to destroy the wilderness. We need to think very carefully about what we want to do as human beings and how we want to interact with nature. So we need to respect nature to the point where we sometimes sacrifice our own satisfaction. People can help.
Yes.
That's the message.
Yes.
There's a number of things that people can do.
Right.
And sometimes they don't seem direct, but they are. Eat less meat for other things. Let that chicken live.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah, great.
I mean, I could talk forever. My lectures are 3 hours.
Right.
And then I would very much appreciate if somebody would walk me.
Yes,
because
absolutely.
I don't have my compass, and I'm known for getting lost without my compass.
Right, okay.
And this is
now
all the
time.
Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
And this construction, you know, it's...
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You can learn more and support orangutan conservation at orangutan.org.
And you can follow Dr. Galdikas on Twitter at Dr. Birute.
We would like to thank our instructors for supporting our project,
CGSF for providing us the space,
and of course, Dr. Galdikas for taking time out of her busy schedule to speak with us.
Thanks for listening.
That's a wrap.
And created with CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby.
So good.
Really? Really, Nick?
What? I get my mind so small. I gotta...
Do you want me to... Is that better?
Okay.
You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
Hello, I'm Madeline Taylor. You're listening to a documentary produced for CJSF 90.1 FM's Making Time for Radio project. This is I Am a Fruit Tree.
This is my island in the sun, where my people have toiled since time begun. I may sail on many a sea, her shores will always be home to me.
Simon Fraser University has a bit of a reputation. It's known to be dark, the architecture is often compared to a prison, and everyone complains about the commute. Because we all commute, it's hard to make friends on the mountain. As a student, it's easy to let this stereotype dictate your experience. We fall into the tyranny of the urgent. It's tempting to plug in, power through, and ignore the world around you. Thankfully, there are characters at SFU who break this mold every day.
I'm Shiraz Ramji. I was born in Tanzania, East Africa, on 10th December 1948. At present, I'm 66 year old. That is about 24,000 days, because I love to count my age in days, and I can celebrate my birthday every day. I'm an educator. I'm trained as a teacher and also as a gerontologist, and I call myself a justice-friendly pacifist.
Shiraz is very well known at SFU for a few different reasons. He has lectured, worked, and studied all over campus since 1994. I first met Shiraz when I was a student. He was standing in a main concourse with a smile, giving out copies of his poetry. He wears sports clothes emblazoned with SFU logos and walks like he's late for something. What is striking about him is his lack of pretense. He doesn't expect anything from you when he offers his poetry. It's simply an open invitation to engage. I found this so unusual and couldn't quite figure out what his motivation was. As it turns out, Shiraz is a peace activist. He told me he's been writing poetry since he was a young boy. He calls it part of his activism and uses poetry to start conversations and spread his message of justice-friendly peace.
It was mostly grade 5 or 6 somewhere where the teacher said, "You speak like a poet." I didn't know what he meant, but he says, "Write whatever you are speaking." And he would read it and he said, "This is poetry and you should write it all the time." One day I realized the price of photocopier at my student union was 4 cents. So I said, "Oh, I can afford that." So I said, "Okay, I'll spend $2 every day for my poetry." So I started printing them. And then I started sharing them. That was about 12 years ago.
Shiraz doesn't only do this at SFU. He approaches people in every part of his daily life.
That's always a challenge, whom I should ask. But sometimes it can be like this morning. There was a woman on the SkyTrain. She was reading about elementary educators. So I said, "Oh, I am an educator." So I asked her, "Do you read poetry and where do you study?" And I said, "I write poetry." So I gave her one. So it depends. If I know, like SFU students, is very easy. So I just tell them, "I write poetry. Do you read poetry?" And then they say yes. So I said, "Take one." And if they don't want it, then I say, "Thank you. Okay, next." But even if I didn't have poetry, I would just talk to people. So that has always been my lifestyle.
Back at SFU, Shiraz took me around to some of his favorite parts of campus. On this little walking tour, I discovered that homemade hummus is another tool he uses to connect.
Hi, here she is. Hi, Sarah. How are you?
Hello, Shiraz.
How are you?
I'm doing very well.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so nice to see you.
Nice. I'm thinking of your ice cream all the time.
Oh, I love it.
So my name is Sarah Manassian, and I'm the fitness programmer at SFU Recreation. When I think of Shiraz, I just think of this warm, smiling guy. He would come into the fitness center and he'd always bring us pita and homemade hummus. And it was staffs like would get excited about, like, "Oh, it's Sunday, Shiraz is coming in. He's going to bring his like pita and homemade hummus." And we just loved that. That's probably one of my fondest memories because it happened every weekend, like without stop. And I think that kind of made our fitness center more of a community too, because people would actually come in on the weekends to, because they knew Shiraz was going to come to bring pita and hummus, and they come in on the weekends, so we'd all sit around and eat the hummus that Shiraz would bring.
He got this reaction constantly. What I wanted to know was what in his life led Shiraz to be so open with his community. After getting to know him better, I started to understand the root of his activism.
Well, you see, when I grew up in Tanzania, I was born in 1948, so I started schooling in 1954, and so it was still part of British colony, and so you see all the racism and segregation of all the different racial groups and so on. So you knew what was colonialism, what is dictatorship, and you hear about all the wars and stuff like that. There were schools which were for the European settlers, and then there were Asian schools and there were African schools. Yeah, like even the buses, that segregated place. You had to, like, you got the movies, you had to stand up because you had to sing the "God Save the King" and stuff like that. So we all knew that. And the whole glorification of Britain, how good it is. And it was legally that way, but so some people assimilated with the whole thing and accepted their second class status. I wasn't very keen on that. So it was there all the time.
Tanzania achieved independence from British colonial rule in 1961. To the south, Mozambique was under Portuguese colonial rule. They endured a decade of anti-colonial struggle, followed by a civil war through the 1970s and 80s. In the 1970s, Shiraz taught in Tanzania. There, he supported the African Liberation Movement and its activists.
It was part of the anti-colonial struggle in Tanzania itself. We were quite influenced by Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and Angela Davis. So it was at a global level as well as local level, there was the whole issue of anti-apartheid.
These experiences of colonial violence, segregation, and oppression have made Shiraz very aware of the dangers of focusing on difference.
I mean, I met a lot of the present and the past leaders of South Africa or Mozambique and so on. So they would come to our school and give a talk. So it has been very much part of my struggle, yeah.
By the early 1990s, after decades of working in education, in medical research, in public health, and in refugee advocacy in East Africa, Shiraz was looking for a change. Both of his parents had passed away, and his partner was killed in a bicycle accident while studying in London.
Well, I was in Africa at that time, and she was finishing her master's in nutrition. And that's when it happened. So we were studying together at London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. So I got the news from family and so on of that happened, because she was going to join me. So that was quite tragic. But then I didn't know what to tell people because I'd moved from Tanzania to Zimbabwe. So they didn't know her, right? So it was very hard to tell people. So that was on time when I was on my own. At that level, I'm more of a private person. Like, I wouldn't talk much with about these things, generally, unless people ask me. So when it came to 94, my mission was at least to be involved with anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa, and then independence came in April 94. Mother had passed, my father had also passed in Africa. After the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa was become more independent struggles, right, I wanted a break. And my sister was very ill, so I came to Canada.
Shiraz's transition to Canada was eased by his entry into community life at SFU. A student and an educator for his whole life, he was comfortable at school.
So here is our library. So this is what I call the holy place, the holy land, SFU holy land. It's for everybody.
Shiraz talks a lot about globalizing friendship and how this can be done through sharing food with your community. Food was a central theme in all of the conversations I had with Shiraz. This is Celeste. She taught Shiraz when he took a movement class at SFU.
There is an unforgettable story. Every student in the class is required to teach the rest of the class a dance. It could be a circle dance, a folk dance, but they have to make it up from scratch. Shiraz taught us a dance called the hummus dance. It was like a group dance around food globalization, and we danced the hummus, we made the hummus through dance. The joy that he brought to this piece and the love that he brought to this piece was so truly moving.
Shiraz doesn't believe in the idea of strangers. He thinks it allows for fear and separation.
Because I don't have many family members, so I just interact with people as if they are part of the family. Mm-hmm. So when I'm going in the morning exercise, I'm feeling I'm with the community. And so it's a way to break the barrier of being lonely or isolated.
To be honest, I don't know what the words are for it. I feel a feeling when I think of Shiraz. I think maybe the thing that's different about him is he'll engage anybody and everybody. He's just so welcoming. He's so open. He'll come up, he'll give you a hug, he'll speak smiles. Have you read my poetry lately? Here's what's going on. Do you want some hummus? I'm going to bring you some food. Like, it's every time that you see him.
As I said, I always want to know, first to create that community and make people not be afraid of me or anybody else. But also to hear stories of people in terms of not necessarily private stories, but how do they look at life and how do they respond to people like me. So it gives me a feeling that there are many people who want to create that community, but somebody has to start. Almost every case, I'm the one who starts, and then the ball starts rolling.
I love the sense of his deep curiosity for life. To me, that's what SFU is all about. Now, I look around at SFU and I see them all. They look absolutely, everyone looks bored to death. You get Shiraz walking through here. He just has a love of life. And, you know, it doesn't even need a cell phone.
So it turns out that Shiraz isn't well known at SFU because of his longevity. It's because he reminds people of what they really want from campus. Community and a sense of belonging.
SFU is a happy place, and it's also a place with some challenges. Happiness in a sense, there's a diversity of people. It can be sadness because the education system, so a lot of education is very Eurocentric. And there are a lot of slogans like critical learning or critical thinking, but essentially it's more conformist education. So it can be challenging for you. I normally consider every person is a fruit tree, so I said just enjoy the fruit.
Why a fruit tree?
Well, I was surrounded. I grew up with so many fruit trees. Papayas grow in 9 months. I used to plant a lot of fruit trees. And I think it's a universal food. There's no recipe for fruit trees. It's just fruit. So I thought as a global citizen, it fits in my narrative.
What does community mean to you?
Community is like what I call the fruit salad, right? Where you have a mixture of everybody around. So it's much of a collective experience. I mean, there are a collective experience in SFU, for example. It's a community, right?
His outlook is contagious. But here's the thing. What is a community? A community is a group of people with something in common, but it's often described as a sense. You feel a sense of community. It's not something that geographic locations just have on their own. Shiraz's approach is to make every space into a community.
I believe we all have the capacity to touch into something that is invisible, that is greater than us, on however you articulate it. But it is a love that infuses far beyond the imagination and far beyond our daily living, because our daily living is fraught with so many difficulties. And I think Shiraz has probably had experiences enough to have to empty himself, where he then is tapped into this greater source of love. And I'm not going to articulate certain labels around that, but I believe he embodies love.
I tell people, I believe that I'm not the only Shiraz in the world. There are many people in Shiraz in the world. And, for example, I can relate to you because I see Shiraz in you and you see yourself in me, right? So don't assume you're alone.
His poetry is not only in print, it's the impression he leaves on people. His embodiment of the fruit tree allows him to connect and create openness and curiosity in the people he meets. He makes eye contact, simple conversation, and impacts SFU by building community through the simple act of constant and unapologetic engagement.
That's what I tell people. Take your part. If you need help, come and have a tea with me.
Well, on that note, can you share a poem or two with us?
Yeah, okay, I'll share with you the one, my favorite one, which is my autobiography of as a child. It's called Be a Mother Earth. I'm a fruit tree. I'm a fruitful tree. I'm a banana tree. I grow bananas shaped like human lips to share and tell stories with my global friends. I'm a cherry tree. I grow cherries shaped like human eyes.
This documentary was produced with the support and assistance of CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia, and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. I would also like to thank Shiraz Ramji, Celeste Snober, Sarah Manassian, and Victoria Haraway for their voices and stories.
Her shores will always be home to me. Oh,
Dear listeners, as you may have heard, Meta, which owns Instagram and Facebook, is blocking Canadian access to all content created by news providers, including this radio station, in response to the Online Broadcasting Act. Access to local news and information matters to everyone, and while radio stations use their airwaves to keep you informed, we also use social media to share local news, events, and initiatives, and even content about our upcoming programming. We need you to write your MP and convey your concerns. Learn more and find a letter template for your MP on our website. Thank you for your support.